Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Bruce McCullough, and I'm representing the appellants and plaintiffs below, Paul Berger, Apartment Managers, Inc., and Alban Park, Inc. Argument on behalf of the appellants this afternoon is going to be presented by Jeffrey Ogren of the Philadelphia law firm of Buchetto & Lentz. Mr. Ogren has been admitted by this court pro hac vice. I would introduce him to the court and ask that he be permitted to make the argument.
And welcome to the court. Did the clerk explain our clock system to you?
Yes, she did, and I believe I understand. It looks pretty straightforward. Thank you.
Well, when you see the yellow light, you're into the time you reserve.
Okay.
And you can continue, but you will be using the time you reserved.
All right. Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. As you know, my name is Jeffrey Ogren, and again, I'd like to thank you for letting me appear here at Pro Hoc Vice. I represent appellant Paul Berger, Apartment Managers Incorporated, and Alban Park in this appeal of two orders, which granted summary judgment as a result of the court determining that the claims for breach of contract, professional negligence, and negligent misrepresentation were barred by Delaware's three-year statute of limitations. We believe the court erred in granting these motions because we believe that there were various genuine issues of material fact and dispute. And because these kinds of cases turn on the facts, I'd like to give you a brief factual background. Mr. Berger is a 71-year-old German immigrant to the United States. He came here in 1958 at the age of 20 years old, became a commercial airline pilot, and worked in that profession until 1984 when he retired. When he retired, he purchased two apartment complexes in Newcastle County, Delaware, and began to run those. When he did purchase those, he eventually retained the services of the lawyer defendants to help him with legal issues relating to the apartment complexes. He also hired the accounting defendants and to help him with accounting issues relating to the apartment complexes.
Are these the only complexes he owns? Is that in the record?
I'm not certain, but to my knowledge, these are the only that he owns. Over the course of the years, the accounting defendants and the lawyer defendants would communicate amongst themselves on Mr. Berger's behalf. In 1997, Mr. Berger needed to refinance these properties, which, by the way, were held in his individual capacity, in his own name. He went to GMAC as a lender, but GMAC was uncomfortable lending him the money without there being a corporate structure of some sort. So Mr. Berger contacted the lawyer defendants. The lawyer defendants were then put in charge of working with GMAC to assist in this whatever reorganization GMAC needed so that he could get this loan. Mr. Berger did understand and testified to this in his deposition that in the 70s, this relates back to the 70s, that if a corporation was to own real estate, that it could be subject to a double tax. So Mr. Berger was concerned about this and did raise this with the lawyer defendants. The lawyer defendants set up an LLC, and Mr. Berger asked whether that LLC would keep his tax situation the same as it would if he was holding the properties in his own name. And they assured him that it would. And our accounting expert agrees that in fact would be the case, that when Mr. Berger then transferred his properties to the LLC, and then Mr. Berger then owned the 100% of the LLC, that his tax consequences would not have changed, according to our accounting experts. But GMAC was not satisfied with this arrangement. GMAC wanted there to be some other corporate entities, and the lawyer defendants worked with GMAC, and then incorporated Alban Park and later, or may not be later, I may have mixed up, but Apartment Managers Incorporated. So those two corporations were created. When they were created, Mr. Berger asked whether those corporations whether that would change the structure, whether that would cause him to have a tax liability based upon his earlier understanding about the double tax. He was assured that it would not because of the LLC. He was assured that the LLC would take care of it. So what they then did was they transferred the 100% ownership that Mr. Berger had in the LLC to 99% to one of the corporate entities, 1% to the other corporate entity, and then Mr. Berger then owned the corporate entities, the stock in the corporate entities. And it was Mr. Berger's understanding, based upon the representations of the lawyer defendants, that he would be tax neutral. It would not change the way he would be taxed as from when he held these properties in his own name. Mr. Berger, once they did do that, Mr. Berger went to the accounting defendants' offices to sign documents that would set up a taxpayer identification number, and he did so. He also believed that the lawyer defendants and the accounting defendants were communicating about this reorganization. It's significant that our accountant determined that, our accounting expert determined that the structure as it was presented ultimately would, and the advice that was given to Mr. Berger by his attorney defendant, the lawyer defendants, was not incorrect in that when with the final structure that his tax consequences would not change, but that would only work if they elected subchapter S status for those two corporations. And that was not done, as we now know. And that is significant because the advice that they gave was not wrong, but it was wrong when they did not elect that S chapter status. Okay. So Mr. Berger then, this was all effectuated in 1998. It all ended, the reorganization. In 1999, Mr. Berger then hired Ms. Pitone, Pam Pitone, to do his accounting and taxes, and he replaced the accounting defendants with her. Ms. Pitone recalls telling Mr. Berger that you someday should consider changing these corporations to S corporations. And Mr. Berger also recalls one conversation that occurred back in 1999 with Ms. Pitone, where she said to him, someday you should consider converting these corporations to S corporations.
Someday? But, or was there, is there a time window when this has to be done?
Well, there is a time window when somebody needs to elect for the S subchapter S, and that's 75 days, it's my understanding, 75 days from the date that the corporations are incorporated. So when by the time Ms. Pitone was involved in 99, that period had already lapsed. So,
how could he follow that advice then?
Well, I guess that's a very good question. I guess they could have elected later, but it would not have had the same tax consequences that it would have had if he sells it. It would have a different tax consequence because ultimately they did put one of the corporations. It did actually elect S corporation status.
Well, you mentioned these conversations with Ms. Pitone, and that seems to be probably the linchpin of the Superior Court's decision, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's one linchpin that right. We believe is incorrect because even though Ms. Pitone does make this reference to the S corporation, she says this to him. It's not in the context of if you ever sell these, you're gonna get a double tax. It assumes Mr. Berger understands the difference between a C corp and an S corp, and it also you have to look at the context. The context of her talking about this was as it pertained to losses and profits on a single tax return, according to Mr. Berger. That's one of the issues in dispute. Mr. Berger recalls one conversation where this was talked about just about one over one tax form. Ms. Pitone says that she told him each year that someday you may want to change this to an S corporation.
Well, let me stop you at this point. I understand your position to be that the court shouldn't have granted summary judgment because there's a material issue of fact as to what he knew and at what time he knew those things, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but I understood that for purposes of the statute of limitations and it's being told, that it's not just what a particular party knew, but what a party could have known in the exercise of reasonable diligence, that you don't get to toll the statute of limitations just because you're not versed in tax law, for example. You get to toll the statute of limitations if you are affirmatively misled, perhaps, by someone that you have a right to repose confidence in. But here, in 1999, which is well beyond what the statute of limitations would be, 1999, your client is told there is an issue with respect to the status of this corporation, namely whether it's a C corporation or an S corporation. And it's an issue that you, the client, might want to look into, even in the your version of you know what was or wasn't said. Isn't that more than enough to put your client on inquiry notice? In other words, I don't know exactly what I was just told by my accountant, but this has something to do with my taxes. I better look into it.
I would submit that it does not. It does not put him on inquiry notice. And the reason it does not is you have to look at the, if you look at the timing of this, the reorganization occurs in 1998. Now we're 1999. And in 1999, he's now having a discussion with Ms. Pitone. He already feels comfortable that his lawyers, defendants, have done everything properly. He has no reason to believe they haven't. And nobody's ever told him that this is done wrong, that if you ever sell these. And I think what happens is she says this to him. He's not thinking, oh, boy, somebody made a mistake.
No, I understand that that's not what he thought. You know, I'm perfectly willing to accept that it wasn't until he was about to sell the property that it finally, you know, hit him that there was a problem here. But, again, as I understand the law, it's not what this particular person thought or understood. It's whether there was something that happened that put him or anyone, a reasonable person, on inquiry notice. And you're saying no because he wasn't thinking about it that way. But does it matter how he was thinking about it? Isn't this an objective standard?
I think it does matter how he's thinking about it. But I think there is the standard that the court set forth in the Coleman case, and in that case, there was the email that the plaintiffs received that discussed, I'm going to divert from GAAP. Principles. It was an accounting malpractice case, and when you looked at that email, one might conclude, "Oh boy, here's a red flag. This is a red flag. This puts you on notice that something was going on here because these accountants were saying they were going away from the GAAP principles." And the Coleman Court ultimately said this was not a red flag. This was not a red flag because there were other inferences. And I would submit that this is not a red flag. Ms. Pitone saying this to Mr. Berger is not a red flag. Had she said something to him that says, "Hey, this is going to affect how you own these," or a corporation should not be holding real estate like this in a C corporation status. It should be in an S corporation status. Absolutely, he had an obligation to carry forward. The difficulty we have here is, and it's what this court has grappled with before in Coleman and in other cases, I guess Isaacson, Stolper, is we have a professional, the professional lawyers, the professional accountants, and we have a simple man, and we're almost asking for this simple man to find that which the mistake, that which the accountants and the lawyers made.
Well, no, wait a second. As I understand it, it's not that the client is supposed to find the mistake, but that if something happens that gives the client any reason to question what his tax status is, that at that point the statute of limitations starts running again because he's supposed to be diligent in looking into these things.
I agree with that principle 100%. But I don't believe it applies the factually that it applies to Mr. Berger. Mr. Berger was...
Let me just try to ask the same question slightly differently. One could read this conversation as saying there's something more you should think about doing. And the logical question, even for a simple person, it would be to say, well, what do you mean? I thought we did everything perfectly last year. Based on Ms. Pitone saying, you need to think about doing something else, why wouldn't it be logical for anyone to say, well, why do I need to think about doing anything else when I had everybody do it perfectly last year?
I understand that point. I think if you look at the conversation that Mr. Berger reports having had with Ms. Pitone, he says when Pam Pitone suggested that sometime in the future it might make sense to convert to an S corporation after these losses were eaten up, it had nothing to do with the sale of the property or anything might be wrong. It's, hey, once these losses are eaten up, you may want to convert to an S corporation. I don't think it's the red flag that the court was looking for in Coleman. It's not a red flag because it didn't trigger anything for this man. On the heels of the reorganization, on the conversation that he had with Ms. Pitone, she's not saying anything's wrong. She's simply saying once in the future it might make sense to convert to an S corporation after these losses were eaten up.
Can you help me with the issue of when you're on perhaps should be making an inquiry based on your own personal knowledge? Your client apparently testified that corporation is not the appropriate ownership in this kind of business because nobody wants to pay double taxes. Now, he knew that before this all started, right?
Yes.
Let's take an extreme example. The most sophisticated, knowledgeable accountant goes in and gets the very same advice. Do we just set aside the knowledge that the client has and it just doesn't matter? Is it
No, I don't think we set aside the knowledge that the client has. But in our case, Mr. Berger has an understanding. He then approaches the attorneys, the professionals, and asks them specifically about this. And they assure him it's the LLC, Mr. Berger, that takes this, makes this to have no negative tax consequence for you. It's the LLC. They assure him not on one occasion. They assure him after when they first do the first LLC. And then when they add the corporations, he asks them, that's what he testifies to, about it. And they assure him, no, it's the LLC. If it's very important to remember that this advice that Mr. Berger had in the 1970s actually is not right. He wasn't right. He was only right if his lawyers made a mistake by electing the S chapter or failing to elect S chapter status. Otherwise, this would have been a tax-neutral situation for Mr. Berger. It's that mistake. So he was actually wrong when he believed that, oh, if you hold a corporation, you get a double tax. You only get that if it's not elected properly, and it wasn't elected properly. And I would submit that Mr. Berger is allowed to have confidence and have trust in his professional. That's what the law encourages. This court embraced that in Isaacson-Stolper. When you looked at the New Mexico Appeals Court, that's what should be encouraged, confidence and trust in the professionals. And that's what he did. He trusted them, he had confidence in them, and it wasn't until he found this mistake that he then went into action and he filed suit, and I would submit in a timely fashion.
Do you want to save your remaining time?
Yes, I would. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Colleen Shields, and I represent the attorney defendants Henry Hyman, Daryl Baker, and Hyman Aber and Goldlust in this matter. The first thing that I want to bring to the Court's attention is my client's challenge to jurisdiction. We raised this, and it's an issue that can be raised at any time, and we raised this issue because the appellant's appeal in this matter was not timely filed. There was a final disposition as of the date of the October 31st, 2007 order rendered by the trial court dismissing the action in its entirety. It was an unqualified decision that did not retain any counts of the complaint. Thereafter, the plaintiffs sought clarification from the trial court regarding the impact of that order on their declaratory judgment claims. The trial court held a teleconference and invited written submissions. But the teleconference and the written submissions didn't even make it to the docket, the prothonotary's docket, because the prothonotary had treated the October 31st, 2007 order as the final disposition that it was. Therefore, the appeal period, the 30-day time period for noticing appeal from the October 31st, 2007 order began ticking as of that date. The only way for the plaintiffs in the underlying action to successfully toll that appeal period is through filing a timely motion for re-argument. That's well-established law in Delaware. They did not timely file a motion for re-argument. And I'd like to point the court's attention to the decision, Penmart Realty Company versus Pearlman, 529A2nd 772, a 1987 decision, which is analogous. That was a chancery court decision where the parties following a final order requested clarification from the chancellor regarding the impact of the order, and then argued that that request for clarification should be treated as a timely motion for re-argument. And this court held that the motion, that a motion or application for clarification does not toll the running of the appeal period. And also found, and it's well settled law.
Didn't the trial court consider the ultimately consider the October order to be interlocutory because it went on to rule on other matters in the case?
Well, but the trial court doesn't have the authority under the rules or the law to extend the ticking of the appeal period by accepting, if we want to say that the court accepted the plaintiff's submissions requesting clarification as a motion for re-argument, therefore tolling the statute of limitations, it was still untimely. And under Superior Court Rule 6B, the trial court does not have jurisdiction or authority to extend the time for re-argument under Superior Court Civil Rule 59.
Well, so, in some jurisdictions, if there was an order like the one you had that dismissed everything but you forgot something, those jurisdictions provide that implicitly everything else is denied. Now here we could say perhaps the Superior Court forgot about the declaratory judgment action, and the request is, what happened to my declaratory judgment? And the answer could be, well, it was implicitly denied in my dismissal. Or the court could say, I forgot about it, here's my answer. Now, if the court said something to the effect, I forgot about it, here's my answer, why wouldn't that constitute the final judgment? Because what purported to be a final dismissal really wasn't, to the extent the court forgot something.
But I would argue that the rules would provide that the mechanism for the plaintiff or the party seeking clarification of the order from the trial court would be through motion for re-argument, that once an order proposes to be a final order, that the only mechanism for making inquiry into that is through re-argument. And had they done that timely, they would have successfully told the running of the appeal period until the judge issued the second, the February order. But that didn't happen.
I don't want to take up your time. I don't remember the name of the case specifically, but I remember what happened. We had an appeal from the Court of Chancery in denying specific performance, and the alternative claim in Chancery was for damages. Everyone forgot about damages. And when it got to our court, we said, what happened to the damage claim? And everyone said, well, we forgot about it. And we said, well, your appeal from the denial of specific performance is now interlocutory because there's this undecided damage claim. And by analogy, it seems there's an undecided declaratory judgment claim here.
Well, I think the answer to that is that there is not, and that's the second kind of prong of this argument, is that the plaintiff's claims for declaratory relief in the underlying action were, by definition, completely derivative of the claims for legal negligence or professional negligence. And so once the trial court made a decision that the underlying claims for legal negligence were time-barred, then the claims for declaratory relief derivative of those claims would then also be time barred.
All right, well, we'll sort this all out. Do you want to address the merits?
Yes, I would like to, Your Honor. I think that the court focused on the important issue in this case, which is the consultation with the independent tax professional. The arguments that the appellants have made are that they should be afforded relief under a time of discovery exception to the statute of limitations. But what the time of discovery exception to the statute of limitations holds is that you're granted relief where there is an inherently unknowable injury. And in this case, the injury was clearly not inherently unknowable because the tax accountant, the professional, Patone, recognized in August of 1999 when they prepared the tax returns for the corporate entities and Berger's personal tax returns, the problem. It's immaterial whether or not they explained the full extent of the problem to the plaintiffs at that point in time. The important point is that they raised the issue and that Patone's undisputed testimony at her deposition, pages 48 to 57, was that that she had, in fact, recognized the problem and the potential tax consequences associated with holding the real estate in a C corporation as opposed to an S corporation.
Well, wait a second. When you say that the undisputed testimony, that may be her undisputed testimony as to what she said, but that's not what Mr. Berger says he remembers. So we do have a dispute as to what was told him by Ms. Patone, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. There's a dispute as to what was told to him by Patone, but there is no dispute that Patone recognized the potential tax complication,
Wait a second. So you're saying that if I have a medical problem and my first doctor doesn't take care of it properly, there's malpractice involved, but I don't realize it. I just know I'm still not feeling well, but I'm not given any indication why. I go to another doctor, and that other doctor says to himself, oh, this looks like the first doctor didn't take care of something. But my second doctor doesn't tell me. At that point, I'm on notice. How is that?
Well, it's not the issue of the fact that she didn't tell him. She didn't tell him that there had been negligence, but she told him that he may want to consider an S corporation. At that point, the reasonable person, I would think, should be on inquiry to say why, at which point she had the knowledge that there was a problem with potential double tax liability, something he had acknowledged he was aware of back from the 70s. So I don't think it's important. The plaintiffs have focused that there's a factual dispute as to what the substance of the communication was. And under the law, the substance of the communication is immaterial to the analysis of the statute of limitations.
Well wait a second. Doesn't the communication that is supposed to put you on inquiry notice, doesn't it have to be of a nature that a reasonable person would respond to that information by saying, oh, I better look into this. This may be a problem, right?
Yes.
Okay. So if we are all in agreement on that kind of informal wording of the standard, what we've got, if I understand the record, is we've got a professional who recognizes that there's a tax problem here, but arguably, only says, you know, Mr. Berger, you ought to consider converting to S corporation status at some future time. Tell me how that gives a reasonable person inquiry notice that there's a problem with something that was done already, as opposed to inquiry notice about, well, you know, I don't know why I'd want to do that in the future. I'll worry about the future later. What is it about that conversation that puts a reasonable person on notice that something in the past was done wrong?
Well, I believe it's that conversation together with his acknowledged past knowledge of the potential tax consequences associated with holding real estate in a corporation, together with the fact that he's signing tax returns that that are for C corporations and not S corporations, which don't show what he says he thought was supposed to happen, which was the pass-through of losses or gains without any impact upon him. So I think it's a combination of all those factors, which the trial court reasonably considered in finding that that was enough to charge this particular plaintiff with inquiry notice, that given those circumstances, a reasonable person would be on inquiry notice to say to their tax professional at that point, and on every tax time thereafter. The complaint was filed 7 years after the alleged negligence in this case. So I think it was the combination of those factors, and the important point being that the consultation with the independent professional, which distinguishes the cases that plaintiff cites, Whittington, Coleman, and Isaacson, where there was no consultation with an independent professional. I think I've gone over my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court, I'm Paul Cottrell from Ty & Cottrell. I'm here on behalf of Keith Thompson and Ballard Thompson Firm, the accountant defendants, and Mr. Keith Thompson is here with us today. I just want to hit a couple of points first that are peculiar to the accountant defendants that are alternate grounds that the Court can uphold the trial court's decision. The accountant defendants are entitled to summary judgment since Berger himself admitted that the accountant defendants were never engaged to give any advice about this deal. That is an undisputed fact. So it's clearly beyond the scope of their engagement.
Well, wait a second. If you're looking to affirm the judgment on that basis, the decision below had to do with the statute of limitations.
Correct.
And what you're saying is that that the plaintiff failed to state a claim against your client or that your client is entitled to summary judgment on the merits because it was beyond the scope of their services. That has nothing to do with statute of limitations, does it?
That is correct. It's an alternate grounds that I think this court can rule in favor of the accountant defendants.
But the Superior Court did not address that.
That is correct. These were issues presented to the court below. But the decision is narrowly focused on the limitations issue. That is correct, Your Honor.
And well, why don't you use your 3.5 minutes to talk about the statute of limitations?
I will. I just want to point out also a second alternate grounds for the accountant defendants is the engagement letter that was annually sent to Mr. Berger that said any cause of action would accrue at the time services were performed, and we're well beyond the 3-year limitation period in that regard. With regard to limitations and inquiry notice, I simply want to point out that the reply brief suggests that this is a jury question and not one ripe for summary judgment, and that is incorrect. There are some 5 decisions that I will briefly talk about that allow summary judgment in circumstances similar to this. Kaufman versus C.L. McCabe and Sons, Inc., which is at 603 A. 2nd, 831, Delaware Supreme Court decision of 1992. In that case, plaintiffs were sold an insurance policy by defendants. They requested loss of use coverage. They received the policy June 4 of 1986, and the policy did not provide for loss of use coverage. A fire occurred March of 87, and plaintiffs brought suit in July of 89. The plaintiffs had never read the policy. The Supreme Court stated that a party to a contract cannot silently accept the benefits of a contract and then later object to the perceived disadvantages, and they held that plaintiffs were on inquiry notice on June 4 of 86 when they received the insurance policy. We submit that this is similar to the case here, where you have a great number of documents that Mr. Berger reviewed but never read that would have indicated that this deal wasn't structured as he indicated, that should have led him on notice, which includes the deeds he signed, certificates of incorporation, operating agreements for the entities, as well as yearly tax returns for many, many years, as Ms. Shields just pointed out. A second case is Ruger versus Funk, 1996, Westlaw 110072, which is a Delaware Superior Court case. In that, plaintiffs bought property in 1986. At settlement, plaintiffs were notified that other individuals, the Deans, may have an interest in a portion of the property, and this gave notice to the plaintiffs that the deed title search provided by legal counsel might be defective. In fact, the Deans brought suit against plaintiffs. This was eventually settled. But then February of 89, plaintiffs were provided a letter by the same attorney in which he stated that several parcels of the property had defective title in some way. Plaintiffs eventually brought suit against the attorney defendant in February of 99. This was dismissed without prejudice, and in 91, the state informed the plaintiffs that they only had an easement right of way over six of the properties.
And did you cite this case in your opening brief or your answer?
No, this is an issue brought to my attention in the final reply brief, which indicated this is a jury question. So I apologize, and let me give you the other cites.
Unfortunately, your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I wanted to go back and just revisit Ms. Pitone for one more point, and that point is Ms. Pitone, according to Mr. Berger, did not counsel him to do anything with the information that she gave him. In fact, to the contrary, she did say, someday you may want to consider. This was not, again, the red flag that, boy, you should consider this, something affirmative. This was, someday you might want to consider this. And again, it had nothing to do with what would happen if you sell these properties. It only had something to do with a particular tax form that they were looking at.
Well, the forms that he was signing were contrary to his expectation, weren't they, about tax consequences, everything continuing as it was?
No, actually, it was not. As I understand it, first of all, Mr. Berger never turned a profit, ever. So all he ever saw were losses. There was nothing that ever even occurred tax-wise to him.
But these did not pass through to him.
The losses. I don't think I have a handle on that fact. I'm sorry.
If it wasn't a subchapter S, they probably did not.
Right.
Which would lead you to think he would say, we've got these great losses. Why aren't I getting any benefit from these losses?
Well, and Ms. Pitone addressed with him, his quote was, Pam told me that sometime in the future it might make sense to switch over to an S corporation, but not at that time, because of these losses, and they couldn't be eaten up if you convert to an S corporation. You could lose these losses. I think it's dangerous to try to impute all this tax knowledge to an individual who is hiring tax professionals to give him information. I'm sorry.
Your time is up also.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see that.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you both. Thank you, all three of you. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and we'll adjourn.